This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dobank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
So we're here in the Jodcast studio with Evan Kinn. I don't know if you remember him, but he was a John Dobank PhD student. He left a few months ago to go to Max Planck in Bonn to do his postdoc. And we were here in a conference called The Black Holes in a Violent Universe. And he gave a talk, a very interesting and controversial talk a little bit. So, Evan, could you tell us a little bit about your talk? And mainly, the title of the talk was Sparkers. So, what is a sparker?
What is a sparker? Well, first of all, was it really controversial?
I think it was.
Oh, I guess that's good. Okay, well, I spoke about something called sparkers. This is just a name that we've given to a couple of events that we've detected that we don't really know what they are. They're really bright radio bursts that happen once. We've tried to see them again. We're confused as to what they are. They're really interesting because they're really bright. The obvious solution to these kind of bursts is that maybe it's a pulsar that goes bang. But pulsars don't just go bang once. And if you try to see them again, you usually succeed with pulsars. But these seem to be single events that just happen once. And the possible explanations for that are a little bit exotic.
So are they definitely real?
They're definitely real, yes. And I should say, they're, in my opinion, definitely astronomical.
Okay.
These are found in pulsar surveys. So pulsar astronomers are always doing surveys all the time, looking for new pulsars. We have about 2,000 that we know about now. But we're always searching for more. We always want to find the best one. We also find these bursts in these same surveys that aren't necessarily pulsars. They can be from anything because these are just radio surveys. In this search for pulsars and other astronomical objects, we have the problem of interference. So anything like mobile phones and Wi-Fi signals and radar towers and TV communications, this kind of stuff can ruin your observations, and I'm very well aware of that. I spent some of my PhD trying to remove effects from Manchester Airport in John Dobank observations. But these guys don't look like that. They're definitely astronomical in origin.
What tells you that they're astronomical?
Well, a few things. The telescope we used to find these is the Parkes Telescope in Australia. And we used a receiver on that, which is like a camera, but it's a radio one. And we had several pixels on the sky. Actually, we had 13, so not very good camera, I guess. But this is what we have on our radio telescopes. And these pixels are spread over a large area of the sky, a few degrees, actually. So anything astronomical would appear in one pixel, and one pixel only. Maybe if it was very, very bright, it would appear in the pixel beside it as well. And actually that happens with the very brightest pulsar, the Vela pulsar. But astronomical signals will appear in one, whereas some signal from Earth, like a radar signal or anything terrestrial, it will appear in all of them because it's not coming straight down the line of the telescope. It's coming in from the side and it's really bright. So that's one thing that tells us that it's astronomical. Another thing is that the radio signal, when it arrives at us, it has some characteristics that tell us that it's astronomical in origin. For instance, the high frequencies arrive before the low frequencies. And this is because the signal has to crash through a load of stuff on its way to the Earth. And the properties of the medium are such that the high frequencies arrive first. But anything that comes from Earth, the high frequencies and the low frequencies come at the same time because it hasn't come very far.
Okay, so let's see that this is real, that it was something astronomical. So what do you think it was then? What's the explanation?
Now that's the question.
Is that the controversial bit?
Yeah.
Oh, the question's not controversial. Well, this is the problem I had. So in my PhD, I found some sources. They're mostly pulsars. There were a few, I don't know what they are. One in particular, I really don't know what it is, and it seems quite interesting to me. It's a single burst, quite bright, and I said that you get a frequency-dependent delay. Well, the more delayed it is, the further it has come from. And you can use that to have a guess at the distance of this source. And if you do that, it turns out this source is very distant. In fact, it might be outside the galaxy, and therefore extragalactic. So it could be very far away. That kind of means it's very, very bright. If we were closer to it, it would be very, very bright. Too bright to be a pulsar. So our first thought was, oh, well, maybe we don't actually understand how much stuff is in the galaxy. Maybe it's in the galaxy, but there's just more stuff in the galaxy. It's actually nearer. In that case, it's a pulsar. But, okay, it's a pulsar. That means if we look at it, we'll see more pulses. And the pulse we saw was actually quite bright, so we should have seen some weaker pulses too. The survey observations were about half an hour. But to be sure, I asked the people at Parkes. I wrote a proposal to use the telescope to observe this thing for like 15 hours. Just stare at this point in the sky and see what we hoped were more pulses. If there's more pulses, it's a pulsar. Okay, mystery solved. If there's no pulses, okay, it can't be a pulsar, or else it's the weirdest pulsar in the galaxy, and we don't know what it is. So they let me use the telescope, and I observed for loads of hours, and I saw absolutely nothing.
Okay.
And any well-behaved pulsar, like the Crab pulsar, if you were to move that to the edge of the galaxy and observe it for that many hours, you would see many pulses, and we don't see that. That doesn't tell you what it is. That just tells you what it isn't. So that kind of line of investigation makes you think, well, it's not a pulsar. Then you reach a kind of stumbling block, because most things that go bang in the radio that aren't from the solar system, like from the planets or the sun, they're pulsars, most that we know about. So you have to go looking for alternative explanations. What can go bang in the radio? And also, what might go bang just once and never repeat? And one of the possibilities for that, that was suggested many years ago by Martin Rees, was evaporating black holes, to introduce an exotic topic.
Okay, so black holes evaporate, do they?
Well, that's the thing. They can do. Stephen Hawking showed that black holes have a temperature, and the temperature is actually inversely proportional to their mass, so which means that the heavy black holes are cold and the lighter black holes are warm. But for any normal-ish black hole, so say the mass of the sun, turns out the temperature is very, very cold. In fact, it's colder than the surrounding medium, so it's actually going to just grow. It's not going to evaporate.
Okay. And you wouldn't detect that temperature anyway.
You wouldn't detect that temperature anyways. So for it to evaporate, it has to be hotter than the CMB, which is just below 3 Kelvin, which is very, very cold. So it has to be hotter than that, or else it won't evaporate. But that means it has to be very, very light. Yeah. So not the kind of black hole that would form from a star exploding at all. So the kind of masses would be maybe 10 billion kilograms. And that sounds big, but that's not very big at all. In fact, if you want a ballpark estimate of how much mass that is, that's about the mass of all humans on planet Earth. It's very low in comparison to the mass of the Earth, much smaller. It's lower than the mass of the Moon by a lot. This is tiny on the scales of stars. So that's the kind of size of black hole you need for this to happen. That's why I say it's quite exotic.
So these are one of the ones called mini black holes, right?
Yeah, mini black holes, exactly, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So they can't form from a star exploding and being the remnant of that. They have to be primordial black holes. So what does that mean? This means that in the early universe, we have some density fluctuations. Not every place in the universe has the same density. Some is a bit more dense, some is a bit less dense. And in some areas, maybe the density is high enough that that little patch of space becomes a mini black hole. And if that happens, then they can do this.
How long do they last for then? Don't they just evaporate straight away?
Actually, this varies a lot. As I said, we're talking about very small black holes, but for a black hole, the mass of the sun, if that were to evaporate, it would take 10 to the power of 67 years, which is one with 67 zeros after it. So that's quite long. So We don't need to worry about that. That's much longer than the age of the universe.
Yeah.
But for the black holes that I'm talking about, depending on the mass, they can take the age of the universe. So if they would be formed at the beginning of the universe and coming to the end of their lives about now.
And sparking,
yes.
So they don't evaporate in a time scale, like, slowly. So they will do a bang and then...
Well, it depends on the mass.
Yeah.
So the smaller you are, the faster you evaporate.
Okay.
And it's actually, if you're 10 times smaller, you actually evaporate 1,000 times quicker. There's a cube factor in there.
Okay.
So it changes from very, very quick evaporation for the small ones to very, very slow evaporation for the big ones quite quickly.
Okay.
But for things that are 100 billion kilograms, that kind of size, they would be evaporating around now.
Okay.
Why do they sort of go pop at the end then?
Well, I say that black holes just evaporate. So they radiate some light, which is losing energy, which is losing mass. And they just do that till they have no more left. But that can't happen, because at some point they get really small. And they're really small and they're really dense, which means to really understand what's happening, you need to understand quantum gravity. Nobody understands these things. So at some point it's not going to go like that. And this was the idea of Martin Rees, that once they reach a certain point, they just go bang.
Okay.
He very famously said in his paper, he worked this out in 1977, so way before we could actually see this kind of effect, he supposed that a black hole, when it had evaporated to a certain point, that it would vomit forth its remaining energy in an instantaneous burst.
that's a direct quote.
That's as good as I can remember from the top of my head, but I don't think I would get away with saying vomit in a Nature paper these days.
Yeah, if you called a sparker a puker, it wouldn't be so good.
Okay, so if they exist, then how many of them are around us? Or how many other bangs can you detect?
That's a really tough question. And the true answer is I don't know. But I can have an educated guess. The number of primordial black holes there are range from 0 to 10 to the power of 25. So there's quite a... There's quite a disagreement. I think most people think that they exist in enlarged numbers. I'm not quite sure why. But maybe we can ask, well, how many of these events of black holes evaporating and with an associated radio burst have we seen? And I mentioned I saw one event that was unexplained. There's also another event which was observed similar to this, and that's also unexplained. And if they work due to black holes evaporating, then there's just two. And we can work out, well, how much of the sky have we looked at to see that? And we can make some estimates like that.
Okay.
And this is when these questions become important, because now we are building amazing telescopes like the Low Frequency Array in the Netherlands. And in some years, we're going to build a Square Kilometer Array in the Southern Hemisphere. And these are huge array telescopes that can see all the sky all the time. So we really scale up our abilities in all ways, and we go from just looking at a tiny patch of the sky at once with one little telescope to being able to see the whole sky, and we're going to see loads of these events. So that's why I'm worried a bit now that we have a handful of these and we don't know what they are.
Yeah.
In a few years we're going to have loads of these, so it would be nice to know what they are.
Is there anything that's telling us that it's not an evaporating black hole? Any evidence?
Yes.
That was a loaded question. I knew you were going to say yes.
Yeah, sorry to spoil the party on that. But so I said I saw this burst and I want to know what it is. I don't think it's a pulsar. So next on my list was, oh, maybe it's one of these radio bursts from black holes. And some very clever people have worked out the expected energy from such an event. So we know what kind of energy this thing would release. And we know how bright these events are that we detect on Earth. So from that, we can infer how far away it must be. And you can work out the distance from that. But also, I said earlier that the high frequencies of this radio signal arrive before the low frequencies, and the delay in that, you can use that to find a distance. Well, you can do it both ways and compare the distances.
Yeah.
And that in some way would tell you whether you're on the right path. So I did that, and they don't really match up.
Okay.
Which was, so my brief foray into studies of evaporating black holes might have yielded a null result in these cases. But I think it's important to keep in mind for all these transients we're going to detect with the new telescopes.
Okay, so if you've got a disagreement about distances, you could also look at it the other way and say, well, we have the DM distance, that's dispersion measure, I'm using a bit of jargon there, which means how much the frequencies have spread out in time. If you got that DM distance, you could use that to say, well, this sparker was too bright to be what we think an evaporating black hole should be, or not bright enough.
Well, if you do that, the distance from the dispersion, which I think we believe to some extent, says that it's too bright.
Okay.
So if a mini black hole was evaporating at that distance, it would be much fainter. We wouldn't see it.
So if you think that is a evaporating mini black hole, will they have a burst also in gamma rays or X-rays or in optical?
Yes, they will. So what happens when this black hole goes boom is that its radiation has created particles, electrons and positrons, and they expand into the surrounding material in a shell very fast, relativistically. It has to be relativistic or this won't happen. And we get currents on the surface of the shell, and we get radiation, and we'll get radio and gamma ray as well, and optical. But radio will be by far the brightest signal and would be the easiest way to detect this if it happens.
Okay. And with these ones that has been observed, there's not a counterpart or no one could observe these?
No. There's another interesting point about this, actually. Because these events that happened, they actually happened years ago. I said that pulsar astronomers are always surveying the sky. Well, not only do they always survey the sky, they always save everything. And they search it and research it and research it. And when a new student comes along, they say, hey, you, search that data. There's probably more pulsars hiding in it. You search it. And that's what I did. And I found these pulses in it. But actually, they happened years ago. And they just happened once. So we kind of have as much information as we're ever going to have on them. And this happened before Fermi was in space. It also happened before the LIGO detectors were on. So for instance, I said these events probably aren't black hole evaporations. Well, what are they? I said, I'm just telling you what they're not. Well, maybe they're from merger events of two neutron stars merging. Maybe they're from a supernova. These are things that would happen just once and might give you a big bang.
But you're saying with LIGO, that's a gravitational wave detector.
Right. If you have a binary system that merges due to the emission of gravitational waves, you have a really strong gravitational wave signal. So if they were due to something like that, you could call the LIGO guys and say, on this day, at this time, we saw a burst. Did you see any gravitational waves? And in practice, that's really what you would need to do to believe this. Because, well, for instance, even if the distances that I calculate from this black hole evaporation model, even if they tallied with my other way of working out the distance, that would just mean that my observations were consistent with the data, but would it make me believe it? This is when astronomers say that they need a multi-messenger confirmation. So you would need a gamma ray pulse or some kind of gravitational wave signal as extra evidence. Otherwise, you just don't have enough to prove it. All you can do is disprove things and maybe gain a bit of confidence.
So if there are more sparkers, then now we've got a better chance of seeing that with several different telescopes or types of observatory, I guess.
Well, I hope so. We've gotten very good in this in the last few years. For instance, we have satellites in space that monitor for things called gamma ray bursts, which I think you've talked about on the Jodcast before. And when one satellite detects this gamma ray burst, the system is so automated that all other satellites can be just zoomed right over to that point within seconds or minutes, and alerts can be sent around the world saying, hey guys, a really bright gamma ray burst just happened. Everyone look over there. So that's where we're at X-ray and gamma ray observations. And I think it's where we need to be at for radio observations, with transients detected with low far and beyond. And I think we will be there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the interview, Evan. It was very good. Interesting.
No problem. I love being in the beautiful Jodcast studio.
And if you find any more pulses, then let us know.
Will do.